Good morning. Lively and interesting, said Ursula von der Leyen. Boris Johnson went with one word, Frank. Oh, to be a moosh on the wall at that Wednesday evening dinner in Brussels, because, tick-tock, tick-tock, 4 years after the vote, Brexit is close to cooked, one way or the other. So many hopes rested on that dinner, so many hopes were dashed. Outlook now, gloomy, and tomorrow is the latest deadline. But before we get into the policy deets, such fun, just what do you serve when the fate of nations hangs in the balance?
It is literally fish on the menu, so they're having pumpkin soup with scallops for starters, and then steamed turbot with mash and wasabi for the main course.
Oh, lovely.
So that's all the information that's filtered out so far. We can read into that what we want.
Is it seen as deliberate,
Tony?
There were
some scallop wars between... Of course it is deliberate, but in a no-deal situation, the tariff on turbot would be about 20%. So lots of hidden messaging in there by the chef, no doubt. But anyway, they have lots more beyond fisheries to talk about, as we know.
Oh, that is fierce, cheeky. Europe editor Tony Connolly with Katie Hannan on Late Debate on Wednesday night. But by Thursday morning, as the Alka-Seltzer fizzed, it was clear that nothing of any substance had been agreed over the cheese board. Some camembert, Ballas?
How dare you? I've the Wensleydale with me.
So, what were the main sticking points?
Fisheries, fair competition, and how to resolve disputes.
Or as we say around these parts, fighting. And given that the UK had blatantly broken the terms of the Brexit withdrawal agreement only a few short months ago, trust was in short supply. European Commissioner Mairead McGuinness spoke to Claire Byrne on Monday.
You know, trust is core to any set of negotiations. And I think the UK side did not help trust. In fact, they broke trust by putting forward the internal market bill. They have the capacity now to rebuild trust by not doing this again, not inserting those clauses and moving in the negotiating room on the three core issues that remain to be solved.
And when you talk about governance, is that a way of making sure that the UK will actually stick to any deal that is established with them by the EU?
In simple words, yes, because we already, and I'll repeat it, we negotiated the withdrawal agreement. We signed it. It is an international treaty. And yet the UK are breaching that in terms of what was going through the House of Commons and willingly acknowledging that they were breaking the treaty. So for us to be certain on a future trading relationship, not just in the short term, but in the long term, we need a mechanism to make sure that we have compliance. And also it cuts both ways, that the EU and the UK, we would both comply with the spirit of the agreement. And I suppose what this all boils down to 4 years after the referendum, or indeed over 4 years after the referendum, is that Brexit was an emotional idea and nobody understood the full implications of it in the United Kingdom, particularly those who were in favour of Brexit. And we now realise that it impacts on every single aspect of life and business. And if there's no agreement, the impacts will be more severe. There's no winners in this. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens this week, even with a deal, it's a lose-lose situation for the UK and the European Union.
Oh my, but why, oh why, was fish so important to our neighbours?
On fish, I mean, it's a big issue for us here as an island nation, but it's a very small part of the British economy. Why has it become such an important part of the end game?
Because everything about Brexit was nothing to do with economics. It was to do with emotion. And if you remember how the world was 4 years ago in the run-up to the referendum, we had elections elsewhere, which, if you like, showed, you know, the towering figure of a strong male, you know, sovereign and independent and being great and all of those very emotive and appealing slogans. And, you know, if you look back, and in time we will, as to how this referendum was fought, David Cameron foolishly called the referendum, failed to prepare for it, and convinced nobody of the value of the European Union. On the other side, you had really strong patriotic slogans, ironically talking about the United Kingdom wanting to be independent and sovereign, which is interesting historically. And you know, in an election campaign, as I know and you know, sometimes it is the emotion that fuels the decision. But the real truth of it is that if this was simple and straightforward and there was an oven-ready deal, as I think the Prime Minister said there would be, then the oven wasn't turned on.
And no one wants that. Mairead McGuinness with Clare on Monday. So if it's not really about fish, might it be about the so-called level playing field? On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Joey Jones, former spokesperson for Theresa May, had this to say.
Is it fair to say then that the so-called level playing field is really the main sticking point here? Because that's about the extent to which the UK will need to follow EU regulations, and that really cuts to the heart of Brexit.
I think it is, yes. I think that everyone talks about fisheries as a sort of totemic issue because it's, you know, it's about British waters and policing one's own sovereign territory. But I think that the core principle is about the is the UK accepting that in order to bind itself into an agreement with another sovereign body, with the European Union, with a free trade agreement, then there are consequences in terms of relinquishing the ability to shape one's own destiny and instead binding in with some European standards and systems. And the problem is that there continues to be, in particular, an absolute allergic reaction among, you know, big swathes of the sort of Brexit community and certainly of the Conservative Party to any jurisdiction for the European courts. And that's, you know, that is pretty fundamental and really does cut to the heart of the issue. Having said that, the logic behind the sort of imperative for a deal is so profound that I think on both sides that there remains an assumption, a sort of feeling that they wouldn't really do it, would they? Surely they'll come back from the brink. Well, we're really going to see those nerves tested to the utmost over the next couple of days because it really is the last chance saloon now.
And that sense of surely not was echoed by Tory MP Sir Roger Gale, who spoke to Drive Time's Sarah on Monday. He was one of only two Conservative MPs who'd voted against the Internal Market Bill, and it was now up for debate in the Commons again. And for him, breaking your word was simply not what an Englishman did.
What do you think is about what is happening today, the fact that it has come back before the Commons today, at this point in the negotiations process?
I think the timing is absolutely awful. I think it's inept and I think it's crass. Look, if this is going to be debated, then you don't use it as a threat while you're in the middle of negotiations, as far as I'm concerned. The House of Lords, cross-party, took the offending clauses out of the bill. The government now wants to put them back again. I voted against it last time, you're absolutely right. I shall vote against the government and with the House of Lords this time. For why? Because we keep our word in the United Kingdom. We don't break international agreements and we certainly don't use them. Or the threat of changing them as a negotiating tool. It is quite wrong. And for me, it's unforgivable.
And do you think that that is what happened here, that this was simply a negotiating tool, that these controversial clauses were included to give Boris Johnson leverage in the negotiations? And if so, do you think it worked in any way?
Well, if it was that, then it's been counterproductive. I'm absolutely certain of that. And I think there is a misunderstanding of how mainland Europe reacts to this kind of situation. They're not going to roll over and put their paws in the air because of this. Quite the reverse. Mm. I think various things have gone wrong. I think Monsieur Macron's late in the day attempt to meddle in fishing for purely domestic political purposes was very wrong. I think this is very wrong. I think what the British government is doing or trying to do tonight is very wrong. We shall pay a price for it.
And those clauses were reinserted into the withdrawal agreement. How did that sit with unionists in Northern Ireland? On Tuesday, Sarah got the reaction of DUP MLA Jim Wells.
Do you trust Boris Johnson to look after the interests of Northern Ireland and indeed the interests of the DUP?
I think we've learned a better lesson that we only trust something when it becomes an act of Parliament or becomes written government policy because, as you know, we feel rather let down by the Prime Minister. He came to our party conference 2 years ago and proclaimed that there would be absolutely no change in the status of Northern Ireland. We see the protocol as doing that. We see the agreement that was thrashed out in Cheshire as diminishing our position within the United Kingdom, and we're bitterly opposed to that. Anything that has reduced the impact of the protocol will, of course, be welcome. But it's not in the long-term interests of Northern Ireland to be treated differently than the rest of UK.
And yet it does look, Jim, finally, that that is where you're ending up. It does look like, for example, you may get your office at the EU office in Northern Ireland. You may get your border down the Irish Sea. The DUP supported Brexit. You campaigned for it. Was that a good idea?
Yes, we certainly didn't support a Brexit that envisaged the EU having an office in Belfast. And we certainly did not want any form of customs controls coming into, say, Larne, Belfast or Londonderry. That was never envisaged. And we feel let down because those indications were that that would never happen.
But happen they did. And when Ben Lowry of the Belfast Newsletter spoke to Claire Byrne on Wednesday morning, he spoke of emotion and pride overriding policy and practicality.
Are people worried? Yes, and no doubt there are farmers and there are individual business people who are worried. But very few people, why did people support Brexit? It was an instinctive thing, in the same way that in the Republic of Ireland you have instinctive feelings and instinctive nationalisms and instinctive loyalties. That's what people have. And most people in Northern Ireland who were unionist were sympathetic to Brexit. Of course they weren't, because we all have our lives to lead. Of course people weren't sitting looking at spread charts and so on. There was an instinctive thing, and this is something that I think perhaps needs to be better understood in the Republic of Ireland, that very many people in, let's say, housing estates in somewhere like East Belfast view the world in a similar way to housing estates in Essex or in Newcastle upon Tyne.
And how to meet the competing needs of those who had voted to take back control and those who had never wanted a split in the first place would fall to Prime Minister Johnson, and how he would handle that dinner. But for true blue Brexiteers like Ben Habib, chairman of Unlocked and Brexit Watch, even to RSVP was a humiliation.
I saw your tweet with interest. You say that Boris Johnson is humiliating himself and the UK by travelling to Brussels. Why?
Well, I think he is. You know, he said repeatedly through the course of this year, and indeed it features in the British negotiating mandate, that if we haven't got what looks like a deal by 30th June, which was then extended to the end of July and then to the 15th October, if we hadn't got a deal that looked acceptable, he would walk. And on the 15th of October, he made an announcement to the British people saying that he wouldn't negotiate with the EU unless they came his way on EU state aid law, the so-called level playing field and fishing quotas. And the EU hasn't budged one jot. And here he is, a couple of months later, now tail between his legs, yet another British Prime Minister, the third one in about as many years, going off to Brussels, begging bowl in hand, trying to get some concessions. And he has absolutely called his own bluff. He's brought the United Kingdom into disrepute. He's undermined his own negotiating position. I don't know what he's playing at.
You think he should just walk?
He should absolutely walk. Any sensible, upright, clear-thinking statesman does not set arbitrary deadlines and then allows them to just lapse without taking the promised action. It makes you look like a fool on the international stage.
Fool or not, Boris went to dinner. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Sarah asked Bertie Ahern his view of what might go down as they passed the peas.
Does any real business happen at the dinner itself?
Yeah, I think it will. I think the dinner would be to try to set out what happens over the next few days and if the negotiating teams are going to come back into it. And I think Boris Johnson said two things last year at this time. He said, one, that a failure to negotiate a deal would be a failure in statecraft. And the other, he said that a deal was oven ready. Well, he was right on the statecraft. He was wrong on the oven ready. So hopefully somebody in the Berlaymont puts on the oven tonight and that we do get a deal, because it's in everyone's interest.
And of course, we now know the oven was stony cold. And on Thursday, the EU began to publish details of contingency plans should a no deal come to pass. On Morning Ireland, Mary Wilson asked this of Katie Balls of the Tory-leaning Spectator magazine.
Katie, can we talk about perception and perhaps how perception is damaging these negotiations? Is there a perception in the UK that the EU is trying to punish Britain, to punish Britain for leaving the European Union? And on the other hand, do you think that there's a perception that there's within the UK an ideological obsession with sovereignty?
I think that perception clearly is playing into this to a degree. I think that if you look at, I suppose, sovereignty, you can say how ideological and how pure UB is obviously going to affect the negotiations. And I personally think Boris Johnson, I think that he's in a more fortunate position in the sense that he just carries much more authority on this issue than Theresa May ever did. So I think that some of the almost Brexit ultras, while they'll be looking for something, I think, perhaps more purely sovereignty than what Boris Johnson is, I think so long as he gets his vision, it would be enough to get it for his party. But I do think there's also a temptation to obviously line it up so if a deal is not achieved, no one side wants to take the blame. And therefore, I think there is a place where those on the UK side are quite keen to play up what they think of Brussels intransigence.
Brussels intransigence, you say? Well, on Thursday, Claire Byrne spoke to Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney.
Nobody is questioning here British sovereignty. The only people who are debating British sovereignty are people in London. You know, no one in the EU is questioning Britain as an independent state outside of the EU. What is being questioned is that if that independent sovereign state outside of the EU wants to trade tariff-free into our markets because of the scale and proximity of the UK and all of the other areas in a future relationship that they're looking to get facilitation on data, on aviation, on road haulage, on judicial cooperation, on services and financial services, on a whole range of other things, that because of that interconnectivity, we have to ensure that there's fair competition.
But it works both ways. We need their market too.
Well, I mean, you know, and we will continue to trade, but the question is whether we can avoid the significant disruption that would come with the inability to be able to put a trade agreement in place. But I mean, you know, the EU signed up to a level playing field and fair competition this time last year. That wasn't in dispute. That was essentially the parameters that were set within which we would get a trade deal and a future relationship. And now, because of some perceptions around sovereignty and independence, that seems to be off the table. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the frustration for the EU.
Ooh, at the end of your tether, Simon, are we? Brexit. 4 years in the basting and the bird still isn't cooked. All eyes on Sunday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Tuesday, we had the good news of the first administration of the vaccine against COVID-19 on the island of Ireland. Here's 28-year-old nurse Joanna Sloan at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast.
I felt proud and emotional. We've worked very hard to get to this point, and the health service in general has struggled throughout the fight for COVID-19, so it feels like a momentous day, so very privileged.
And we are inching ever closer to our own vaccine rollout with the publication of the government plan next week with the logistics and just how it's all going to work. So we'll be getting right into it then, fear not. In the meantime, though, have a listen to this.
Let me reach, let me reach.
Cocoa Flow from 1988. And on Monday night's arena, Canadian pianist Chile Gonzalez spoke about his true and abiding love of Enya, a love that had started in his bedroom when he was only 16.
Where did it bring you? What were you doing as a 16-year-old when that was playing on the radio or wherever you were listening to it?
Well, first of all, many of my close friends would argue I'm emotionally still 16, so it's not that difficult. I would say, you know, it didn't sound like anything that was out at the time. You know, the 80s was the time of music videos and Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Cyndi Lauper, very extroverted pop music. And there was something about that song. You couldn't really quite understand the words. It was very mysterious. It sounded a bit witchy, like there was some sorceress that was singing. And right away, it intrigued me as well, because not only was it taking advantage of all the most modern technology with the synthesizers and all of that and the multiple Enyas layered in a beautiful choir, but also it sounded like folk music. So there was something ancient about it as well. Mm. And that's what sort of grabbed me back then and still pretty much grabs me today.
Now, Gonzalez has written a book called Enya, A Treatise on Unguilty Pleasures. And while Enya is massively popular, cool, well, not always.
And at what point did you come to realise that the cognoscenti would have said, oh, how uncool it is of you, Chile Gonzalez, to like Enya?
Well, I went down a lot of wrong paths taste-wise in my life, but Enya was not one of them, because Enya was a product of, I would say, an involuntary childhood taste. That's actually the one we should trust. Then came a bunch of false paths. Jazz fusion, which was meant more to impress people because my ego was so involved in the music. Then later on, I overcompensated for that by getting into very lazy, unvirtuosic indie rock because I wanted to fit into a certain social group. And it took me a while, maybe till my late 20s, till I could really own the fact that I loved music like Enya, that I love reassuring maternal female voices, that in essence, I have the musical taste of a MILF.
Let's put that to one side, that image, just for a second.
Early in the morning for that one. Thankfully, the interview moved on.
We should be more in touch with what we liked as kids, because that's something you could really trust, because that was just a simple yes or no, goosebumps or not type answer. The thing is, when we become teenagers, we start to define ourselves in a very decided, willful way, again, based on a lot of social pressures or maybe differentiating ourselves from our older brother or older sister's taste. But it becomes like a sort of way to show ourselves to the world. This is what I like. This is who I am. Very often those two things are kind of at odds with each other. And that's why people sometimes need to file certain music under guilty pleasure, because there's like this dissonance between the true involuntary goosebumps you're getting and the fact that you feel it's forbidden. A guilty pleasure is when you say, I like it, but I know I shouldn't. And too often people sort of have those categories when in fact it should be as simple as saying, I like bananas or I don't. I like Enya or I don't. In my case, I don't like bananas, but I love Enya. So you should always surprise yourself. You go fishing inside of yourself, and you should be potentially horrified or amused or perhaps seduced by whatever comes out. But it should be a kind of blind process.
Chile Gonzalez on Enya on Arena. And surprise for both writer and reader was key to the work of Indian-born poet Nidhi Zach Arya Ipe. She'd taken part in Poetry Ireland's Introductions programme, which supports young emerging poets. And she spoke to Olivia O'Leary on the poetry programme.
Nidhi, what do you think you learned?
I think something that was really insightful for me was the idea of surprise in a poem, the element of surprise, and that you want to surprise yourself, that your own work should be a revelation to you. I think that was something that I found, yeah, really, really insightful.
And it was the reading of the Elizabeth Bishop poem, Five Flights Up, that had really illuminated this concept for Nidhi.
The thing about it that I love is how it takes us through this journey, through this flight, and towards the end, you have this sense where you started out thinking, okay, yes, I want those questions to be answered. And then at the end of it, you think, well, actually, they don't need to be. You know, that it's the wonder of it, it's the surprise of it, that that's the thing that actually draws you more than, you know, having this knowledge and this certainty, I think, about things. And for me, that's what poetry does. It's not a place that I go to for answers, but it's a place that I go to for wonder, you know, for a sense of ecstatic celebration of what life is in each moment.
Nidhi Zakaria Ipe, as heard on the poetry programme. Munikos Wild's focus this week was books to please and pleasure the wildlife enthusiast for Christmas. And Eilani Launa's choice was The History of the World in 100 Animals by Simon Barnes. And wasps featured in a way that perhaps you might not have expected.
Now, one of the creatures that I'm in favour of, and I'm always trumpeting it, is the wasp. I think it's a much maligned creature, but I never thought in my wildest dreams that wasps are responsible for all our literature. Now, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I can remember the first time I saw a wasp's nest for real, and I was absolutely struck by their beauty. These animals that we mostly treat as wholly annoying create these little masterpieces of these tiny hexagonal cells that they make from chewed wood pulp, that is to say, paper. And the Chinese realised this, that wood pulp, as processed by wasps, could be processed by humans and use it to make paper. And they started to use paper for many things and eventually started to use it for writing, for recording information, for laying information down. And that meant that was the end of oral transmission as the only means of communicating complicated information from one person to another. It meant that knowledge could be stored. It meant that knowledge could be transported. It was as big a revolution as the invention of computers.
Fascinating stuff. That was Simon Barnes on Mooney Goes Wild. Meanwhile, over on Talk to Joe.
The donation was left in a recycling bay. What's to not understand about that?
A good old Liveline scrap. It's been too long. That's the sound of Anthony getting a lot of aggro from callers. He'd left an old child's golf bag by the clothes bank for a passerby to, well, shall we say, avail of. The charity shops were closed at the time. He got fined €150 for illegal dumping. He was annoyed. And Liveline callers were annoyed with him.
Have you any sympathy for Anthony and his golf bag?
No. Absolutely. I'm sorry. Oh, wow. I don't. No, not one bit. Absolutely not one bit. No.
Anthony? No sympathy there, Anthony. Are you there?
Well, it's immaterial to me, Joe, whether it's sympathy or not. It's that where people are being penalised for having good intentions. And that's all. I didn't leave a bed. I didn't leave a kitchen sink. I didn't leave a bag full of household rubbish and nappies and cans.
It doesn't...
And all the type of stuff. So at the end of the day, that's all it was. I think this, it's fiscally driven by the council just to pick up money. That's all.
Well, Anthony, no, I'm sorry. If you go on the council site, there is a page on the council site. If you wanted to do a good deed like that, you could have left your bag on that site and that bag would have been picked up from your home or wherever you wanted to arrange for
the
somebody.
Council,
no,
you
I do
for
not.
Council.
I work for, no-
well,
excuse
you,
me, I work for nobody.
How
I don't
do you
work
know
for
that?
Nobody.
How
sorry,
do you know
how
that?
Do I know
you seem to be. You seem to be. You were saying there, I'm watching the bins, and then you're quoting a diss about the council. I left something in
but
good faith, and that was it.
Excuse
me, I'm speaking. If I just thought that it was going to cost me €150 to do that, I wouldn't have done it in the first place. But it was left with the best of intentions. That's my point.
Ooh, Scorchio. Now, that was about 20 past two on Friday afternoon. A lot of heat on the wireless. But scroll forward a mere 15 minutes or so, and Joe's asking this.
What were you doing when you first started milking the donkey?
Donkey milking. Respect. And that is why you've got to love the Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Monday marked the day when nursing home residents were permitted to have visitors for the first time in months. And one of those people was Paul, who was living in St. Joseph's in Shankillen, County Dublin. Paul has dementia and his daughter Fiona Lang was going to visit him. Cian McCormack brought us this on the News at One.
September the 18th, that was the last time I could see him. For the first lockdown, I hadn't seen him in 16 weeks, and that my mum had just passed away. So that was extremely difficult not to be able to spend time with Dad. And today, it's just be great just to see him, just to have that physical contact, just, you know, a hug, hold his hands, just to see that he's doing okay.
And after the visit, Keane talked to an understandably emotional Fiona.
Just so good to see him. So good to see him. So I got to get a hug, and yeah, no, it's absolutely fantastic to see him after such a long time. It's a relief, you know, it takes that worry off your mind. You know, the photographs and videos, you can send them, but just to actually be able to see him and hug him, and, you know, it's just amazing. It's been a long time. But yeah, relief, happiness, sadness, but yeah, delighted to see him. And he's looking so good. It's just fantastic. Just absolutely fantastic.
God, so, this means so much to you and to other families too, not just in St. Joseph's and Shankill, but in nursing homes all over the country.
Absolutely. It's COVID and the lockup is cruel, but I think it's extremely cruel for people in nursing homes not be able to see their families and their families to be able to see them, because you don't know how much longer they have left, and every day without them is tough. It's hard, but I'm so glad the restrictions have lifted. It means so much to all of us. It's fantastic.
A long time coming. Fiona Lang with Cian McCormack on the News at One. And on Friday, Ryan spoke to Monica, who will get to see her 15-year-old son Patrick today. Her son has autism and is pre-verbal, and he's living in a care setting, and she hasn't seen him since October.
He's just got a most beautiful soul, but we were unable to keep him at home earlier this year, so he went into care, and he's being wonderfully cared for by a group in County Waterford.
Could you explain to me how you know he has such a beautiful soul?
Because when how do I know it? I just know it. It's in his eyes. He's the most amazing eyes. He's a very kind child. He can't help it when he hurts me, because he doesn't mean to hurt me, and he always comes back. And when I walk with him now, he's so tall he can rest his head on my head, and we walk along, and I think people probably think we're lovers when they see us from the back, because his arm is around my arm and we're strolling along with his head upon my head. And then you turn around and you see this most beautiful young teenager with his mom. And pre-verbal, he can say my name, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. He can say I love you, which is really amazing. He said it the first time when I was in a shop in Cork, and I bought a pair of owl earrings, and I haven't taken them off since he said that to me.
How old was he when he said that?
10 years old. I think having Patrick with autism in our lives has kept us so humble and so grateful, and has made my children good children who have good hearts. And I think that's one of the most important things in life, to be kind, to have a good heart. But I am so excited to see him on Saturday.
And how had Monica managed not having seen her son in so long?
Well, initially when he went into care, I didn't see him for 14 weeks, and I think he nearly died and I nearly died. But then I discovered eventually that he was going to be happy there. I cried initially, I think, for the first 4 to 5 months, but now I can accept that I have to leave all my children go eventually. I have to give them wings, and his wings have to be with people of his own calibre and people who are like him and who love him just as he is. So now I can accept it, but I still would love to see him more often.
So what's the plan on Saturday?
Saturday we meet in care in County Tipperary, because it's halfway between Waterford and home, and we just walk together and hold hands, and I bring his favourite bread and his favourite sweets, and he gazes into my eyes, really. That's how we communicate. And we look at the lovely ducks and swans over near Care Castle, and we're just together. It's nothing dramatic, but it's the most fantastic experience.
What a lovely reunion that is going to be. That was Monica talking to Ryan yesterday. It is a big weekend for sportball. Today is Super Saturday, centred around the Women's FAI Cup Final and the All-Ireland Camogie Final. And Sunday sees Limerick v Waterford for the Men's All-Ireland Hurling. But the Camogie, Galway up against Kilkenny. Des Cahill joined Clare and this is how he called it.
I'm going for Kilkenny tomorrow against the Oz with my... I think they're winning Cork. They won the semi-final in Cork. I thought that was a fantastic win. And I know semi-final form isn't everything going into a final. And as you say, Galway are probably more experienced overall and Kilkenny are missing a few. But I think it was a fantastic win for Kilkenny and it gives them a great lift coming in into the final. And while Galway, they're only going for their fourth All-Ireland, Kilkenny has that rich tradition in Camogie as well. And I just have a feeling that semi-final win will bring on Kilkenny a lot.
Now that is pretty definitive. But turns out if you meet Des wearing a Galway jersey, he'll probably go for you guys.
When you give an opinion, I find when I'm walking to a match and someone asks you, you know, they're wearing, say, Kerry colours, who'll win? And you say Dublin, or if you say to Dublin, they get offended. They think you're insulted. They want. So I've now learned.
So you're not supposed to have an opinion, are you? You're not allowed to have an opinion.
No, but they ask you. But I always try and work out.
They don't want the answer.
Where are they from? And then I tell them
what they want to
what
hear.
What they want to hear, always.
Des Cahill, what's that I smell? Would that be your pants on fire, Desmond? Ray Darcy has a Christmas song system, of course he does. The Fairy Tale of New York, for example, is a one bauble song. Explain.
We have a system in the office. It's the five bauble system. You see, each, you know, depending on if it's very Christmassy or not that Christmassy, but Christmassy, it gets a rating of 1 to 5 baubles. So that's a one bauble song. And then what would be a five bauble probably would be Rocking Around the Christmas Tree. That could be a five bauble song. And then in the middle, you might have Last Christmas by Wham. That'd be a 2 or 3 bauble song, you see. And of course, as you get closer to Christmas, you play, you know, the bauble rate goes up. So you wouldn't play a 5 bauble song today, for example, or this week. You'd have to wait till the end of next week.
Absolutely. We'd get Dee Forbes on you for that one. Now, all of that was Monday. But by Wednesday, his bauble was tarnished.
Oh, no. Oh, no. There are certain songs you have to leave alone. You know, there are certain songs you just don't touch because you don't mess with perfection. And anybody who goes near certain songs, well, they're very brave. They're very brave and they need to be very confident and they need to be very certain that they can do something different, that they can change perfection. But of course, perfection is perfection, not to be changed. Somebody should have advised John Bon Jovi about that. John Bon Jovi. They've got cars big as bars, they've got rivers of gold. Right through you, place for the old. You first took my hand on that cold Christmas Eve. Promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome, you were pretty, queen of New York City. With the bands out at play and they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the chunks they were singing. On the kissed on the corner. Stop! Enough. And how did he deal with the controversial lyrics? You're a bum, you're a braggart. You've lost all your swagger. In the word around town, you ain't much in the bed. Call a squirrel. Aha. You're a bum, you're a braggart. You've lost all your swagger. And the word around town is you ain't much in bed. What do you think of that? What do you think of that version of that song? As I say, you should leave well enough alone, shouldn't you? Anyway, you can listen.
Oh, sure, that's the Christmas rune now. Might as well go home. But such was the outrage that this John Bon Jovi cover had prompted. Hard News hacks Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time, no less, got in on the act. They spoke to journalist and wife of Shane McGowan, Victoria Mary Clark.
Did this Bon Jovi version come out of the blue for you? Did Shane know it was coming?
I'm sorry, I had to laugh.
So do we.
Well, he actually did contact Shane and ask permission to change the lyrics, and Shane was fine with it. This isn't definitely not the worst one.
Does he like it?
Well, he actually kind of liked it. I mean, he did actually like it.
Does he mind then when people complain about you scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy, go on? Does he mind that, changing that even?
I think... it's more that he doesn't really get that people don't understand that those are characters, so they're not him. They're people who speak like that. And if you, you know, if you're writing a character, you've got to be true to the kind of character you're writing. You want to sing it. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose like, I know that your thoughts on this, Victoria, are that what tends to get lost in all the controversy that we have now every year about the lyrics and the covers and all of that is what the song is actually about, the message.
Yeah, and that's, thank you for reminding me. I think that the message, you know, that there are still people living on the street who are really just being thrown aside, ignored, looked down on, you know, especially people who've got addiction issues. And obviously Shane is a person who's lived every moment of that song. You know, he's done everything that the people, and he's been a drug addict, all the things. Maybe think more about the fact that there are people still living on the streets, and often through no fault of their own. Obviously, Shane is very lucky because we, and me and him, we got, you know, we made it through and we're still alive. But not everyone does.
Victoria Mary Clark on Thursday's Drive Time. Well, that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And we can only end here.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. An old man said to me, won't see another one.